This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Kerry Kasem. Kerry brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervie and Kerry Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KABC.com. I am Alan Gervie, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn. And I'm here today, as usual, to be the managing partner of your life. And I'm here with the other manager of your life, Kerry Kasem.
Where's my applause, Art?
Art came in late today.
You know,
give him a chance to get
Art.
Settled.
Where's my applause?
Come on, Art.
Myself. I was not late. I
you were late. Well,
no,
you're
He's here. He was on time, but yes.
The main thing is that you're
there. There it is.
A little late. I like the standing ovation.
Very good. I'm bowing.
You are bowing.
There we go.
How's everything going? You put on some makeup today?
I did.
For a change, what's going on?
Well, I'm getting rid of my Lyme disease and Epstein-Barr, and I feel good. I have energy for the first time in 6 years.
I thought you had an event to go to.
No, I did, actually. I was supposed to go to an award show, but it actually started at 4 o'clock. I thought it started later.
Yeah.
So I'm not there now.
Well, last week I was actually in Toronto at my nephew's wedding. It was amazing.
I saw the pictures.
Beautiful pictures. Mm. And he did a great job with Amanda Harlan and Amanda. So congratulations to them. What a great event. And I was excited. And my kids, Hudson and Harper, walked down the aisle, the flower girl and the ring bearer.
So cute.
Yeah.
They're so cute.
Yeah. They had some beautiful pictures there.
The best thing was today. Can we talk about what happened?
What happened today?
I want to take my camera and come do a reality show on parents with little leaguers.
I don't want to talk about that. I got out of control. I was like in court. I was arguing, and the coach of Hudson's team arguing the first base call. And what a coincidence it was Hudson who was called out by a terrible call by the ump.
But everybody was laughing because they knew it was a bad call. And you're like, wait a second, this isn't fair.
I needed a good judge.
There we go.
I needed district.
Yes. Yes.
There we go. I needed Jesse Furman. That's who I needed as a judge. District Judge Jesse Furman. I need a segue into our guest. We can't talk about baseball and weddings all
afternoon. Well, it's a game, and you can bet on games, right? There you go.
Who's U.S. District Judge Jesse Furman?
Somebody that you just mentioned.
That's right. We had Judge Block on a few weeks ago, U.S. District Judge from New York. And one of the things he said, interestingly enough, about sentencing, he talked about sentencing. He said, sometimes you have to look at the big picture and you have to look at what a sentence would mean to someone who was accused of a crime.
Yeah.
And you have to act accordingly. Rather than just throwing the book at someone or rather than not throwing the book at them, you need to look at each individual fact. And I think maybe that's what U.S. District Judge Jesse Furman did in the case of Molly Bloom.
Yes.
See, I had a segue to
it. I knew you were going to go somewhere with it. I didn't want to ruin it.
And there was no, thank you very much, no prison sentence. $200, $200,000 fine, 200 hours community service, and a year of probation. So what are we talking about? We're talking about a passion of yours. I remember a couple years ago, we were at a Super Bowl party. Kerry and I, and we don't go to too many parties together, but we happened to be at one. It was, what, Al Michaels' son's?
Yeah, Steve Michaels.
Steve Michael. Al Michael, of fame of
Sportscaster.
Do you believe in miracles?
Yeah, one of the most famous lines ever. Come out of a...
Yeah, so we were at that party, and I was watching the football game with Marty Cove.
Yeah.
And I just watched Karate Kid with my kids the other day.
Did they like it?
In Toronto. Yeah, they did like it. They weren't in love with it, but they thought it was okay. They were a little young for it.
They're young.
But anyway, we were watching the game, and you were playing poker, because that's what you love.
The whole time.
You didn't even watch any of the game.
No.
And I could care less about poker.
You know, I like the halftime. Does that count at all?
No.
No.
Come on, let's come with me on this.
Okay.
Just follow me here.
All right.
Poker. That's what we're talking about. Not about halftime. We weren't talking about, unless someone like, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio was there at halftime, or maybe Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, A-Rod, Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen, any of those people, if they would have been there at halftime, but that's not what we're talking about.
No.
All right. So I'm being a little esoteric here. Those were the people, some of them, and we'll find out, we'll verify if those were participants in Molly Bloom's
She is never going to say
game.
Anything. This is why
no,
she's
we're not
so
letting her
awesome.
Come on. She's spoken so much all over. The book is called Molly's Game, the true story of the 26-year-old woman behind the most exclusively high-stakes underground poker game in the world. Of course, turned into a major motion picture, 2018 Academy Award nominated Best Adapted Screenplay, Molly's Game, with Jessica Chastain.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing. And what it is, the poker princess, everyone's heard of Molly Bloom, of course, and if you haven't, running the high stakes poker, underground poker games in LA and New York. And we're going to hear the story today right here on Gervie's Law. Aaron Sorkin, the writer and director of Molly's Game, said, Molly is brilliant, strong as a tree, built out of integrity, and he couldn't be more impressed with her. So, Molly Bloom, welcome to Gervie's Law. Come and impress us, Molly.
Wow.
There you
no
go.
Pressure.
No pressure.
None at all.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. It's great to talk to you, Molly. And let's start with a really easy, simple question. What are you most proud of when you talk about everything that we've just been referring to? What are you most proud of?
You know, I guess that what I'm most proud of is I continue to make mistakes and, you know, have failed in spectacular ways, but I keep going and I try to be a better person each time and I try to go bigger each time. You know, I'm just, I guess I'm most proud of my ability to get back up no matter what.
Did you know when you were writing your memoirs that were you writing it in hopes it would be picked up for a movie, or were you completely astounded when they're like, we're going to do this?
Oh, I hunted them down.
Okay.
Nobody wanted to touch this movie. Okay. No one wanted to touch this story. They were so terrified of all the powerful people that were standing opposed to it.
But they knew you weren't going to say anything. I mean,
what do you mean she wouldn't say anything?
I mean, if she would have said something, she would have stopped herself from going to jail, right? So if she's making a movie,
Molly, truth is a defense, isn't it? It's a defense. So if you're telling the truth, as you did, what are you afraid of?
Well, let me just back it up a little bit for a second. So I had no desire or intention to have my story known. This came about as a strategic plan to try to survive the incredibly large mess that I had created. And you know, that my life was reduced to ashes. I was 33 years old, a convicted felon, looking at 10 years, you know, about to be a convicted felon, looking at 10 years in prison, millions of dollars in debt, reputation destroyed, network decimated, and you know, was addicted to drugs and alcohol. There was just this huge disaster that I created of my life, and I had to get sober and I had to get clear and I had to put my entrepreneur cap on and say, okay, sister, what, if anything, is the monetizable asset that's left of your business and of your life? And what I landed on was, there's a unique story here, but there's the dilemma of how do I tell this story without destroying lives and still be able to tell the story? And how do I do it in such a way that I can minimize the great risk that stands between you and a bestseller, that stands between you and a movie that actually does well, because both of these industries are really tough to succeed in. And so, you know, I did a bunch of research on publishing, and I realized that I wanted to own my own intellectual property because the story had been in the public medium, and I wanted to be able to sort of generate as many revenue streams as I could and have as much leverage as I could. So I wrote this book, and the publishers obviously wanted this big, you know, celebrity takedown book. And I was like, no, there's a better story here about a girl from Loveland, Colorado. And they're like, no.
But how did you, Molly, how did you have the guts to do that? Yeah. Because so many people, especially down on your luck like you were, so many people would want to throw people under the bus. And you had this integrity. Aaron Sorkin said you were really into doing the right thing. How could you do that when you had a real easy path of taking down people and you just refused to do it?
Well, I guess there's a couple of reasons. First of all, I was raised, in particular, my mother really raised us from a very young age, imparting the importance of integrity and character and doing the right thing and kindness. And you know, my dad sort of stood on his pulpit and his missions were walk through fear, don't ever play the victim, be courageous, live a courageous life. And so I had these two parents who really instilled these incredible values in us. And that's the first piece of it. And then over time, as I began to run these games and get further and further into this world, I began to get farther away from that moral code and start to make some decisions that were I wasn't proud of, and I knew the way I felt in that world when I was making those decisions that were not rooted in integrity, and all the money in the world and all the freedom in the world and all the access in the world didn't make me happy. You know, at the end of the day, I found myself alone, isolated, you know, using drugs and alcohol to numb out. And so I knew the fallacy of, you know, I knew the fallacy of let's take the easy way out and just, you know, think about myself. Like, I knew that I needed to, if I was going to have a second chance, I needed to get back really firmly rooted in liking myself and having integrity in the choices that I was making.
You know, it's interesting. I saw you speaking and you talked about a saying that I have in my office. I actually have a poster, a picture in my office of Wayne Gretzky saying that says you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. And when I saw you say that, and then I thought in my office, because I look at that every day, you know, as a trial attorney, I'm very aggressive, and I'm thinking, is that really right? Because when you look back on what you did and running these games, do you think that maybe you shouldn't have taken all those shots?
Definitely.
I know that's not what you meant when you said it, but I'm thinking of it too, because sometimes I get myself in trouble and I think, wait a second, it's motivational to take those shots, but maybe sometimes we take too many shots. Maybe Gretzky was wrong. He should have passed the puck instead.
Right. Or maybe if we were smarter and we passed all the time or more of the time, we wouldn't create as much friction as we create in our life by, you know, sort of taking the shots and messing up and then the lessons that we learn from them. You know, like,
exactly.
I guess I think the most growth that I've ever experienced and the most perspective that I've ever gained is from the incredibly dumb shots I've taken and had to, you know, account for them.
Yeah. It's really a fascinating topic. I wish we talked right now about it, but we do have to take a commercial. We're going to come back. We've got a lot to talk about with Molly Bloom. We want to get into some of the particulars because some people who haven't seen the film or haven't read the book, maybe don't know the story, need to hear the story. We're talking to Molly Bloom. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. All right, we're back. What a coincidence.
Poker face.
What a coincidence.
Art.
Nice job, Art. You know, they were talking about in the bumper there, Murphy's Law. I'm not sure why they equate Gervie's Law with Murphy's Law.
Well, it's the opposite.
We're the opposite. We're talking to Molly Bloom. She is the poker princess, and thank you, Lady Gaga, for that lead-in.
Yeah.
There you go. I guess you've heard it. You know, it's funny because in the movie and in the book, when you talk about, Molly, when you talk about you were preparing for your first poker game after Darren Feinstein had have you set this up for the big Wheeler dealers, and you talk about music. I love the part when you talk about playing the music. We just heard Lady Gaga. Was that, that was It was before that song came out, because I think you were stuck on like The Gambler and some of the other old gambler songs that you thought that the poker players would really love to hear.
Yeah, well, you know, I was assigned this task, and the task was, I need you to serve drinks in my poker game and try not to embarrass me. And so I went home, and, you know, I didn't know anything about poker, so I went home and I Googled things like, what kind of music do poker players like to listen to, and what do they eat? You know, I'm trying to figure out this strange thesis. And then I made this super embarrassing playlist with songs like The Gambler on it.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, showed up. I was 24 years old and from Loveland, Colorado, just as, you know, naive as can be. And showed up and waited for the players to arrive thinking, okay, so how hard can this be? It's going to be a bunch of overgrown frat boys. And then Ben Affleck walked in and Leonardo DiCaprio and a politician that will remain unnamed. And
wait, let me ask you that, because yeah, it's interesting. You're naming some people and you're not naming some. I love that when you say will remain unnamed. Why does Ben Affleck and Matt... And
well, they're everywhere. First of all, I mean, any game, any big game, these guys used to be every at every major private big game. Even in Vegas, you'd see them.
But I'm asking Molly if that's the reason, because they're everywhere. Like, yeah, how do you determine? And you had said, you know, you were protecting people, but... People like Darren Feinstein, for instance, you know, he doesn't come off really great as Dean Keith in the film, but his name's out there, even though you changed the names, or Aaron did in the film. People like Tobey Maguire, who we have to talk about. So there are a few people that you have talked about, Ben Affleck as well, A-Rod, Leonardo DiCaprio. How do you differentiate between the ones that you can name and the ones you can't?
So when... The Bradley Ruderman deposition came out, and we can go more into this, but when the player accused of running a Ponzi scheme, sort of that whole situation happened, and the U.S. bankruptcy attorneys looked at all the places where they could recoup money. A big place that they saw was this poker game that Brad had lost over $5 million in.
Bad
so
Brad.
We all got... Bad Brad, right? So we all got sued for the money that he lost, and those depositions came out, and this whole lawsuit was released to the press. And at that time, there were celebrities and players who openly admitted to playing in these games, because it's not illegal to play in a poker game. It's no big deal. It's a home poker game. It's a private game. And so anybody who has, on their own accord, publicly admitted to playing in the game, you know, their name is fair and safe. But if people haven't admitted to it, and that's their story to tell. And secondly, I was pretty steadfast about not telling any stories or real dirt that could actually affect people's lives in real negative ways. You know, I had to tell my story, and obviously those names, having those names involved is a draw. But I only would use them if they themselves had admitted in the public to playing in the game.
I was just going to say, Carrie, because I want to take it one step further. When you talk about Tobey Maguire, though, you do get into things about that you didn't really appreciate some of the things that he was doing, and your relationship with him. I think in the movie and in the book, they talk about him, his character, saying to you, bark like a seal. So there obviously was some discord there with Tobey Maguire.
The story about Tobey I told because, I didn't believe telling a story about Tobey, you know, demanding I bark like a seal was going to affect his life in any great way. But I felt it was a very important story for me to tell, in particular to women.
Yeah.
Because here was this person who was literally a superhero at the time. He was Spider-Man. And he was powerful. And he was, you know, intimidating. And he asked me to do something that I felt really would rob me of my dignity and self-respect. And I knew that, you know, not submitting to this request, which was, you know, became grandstanding and everyone in the room is looking and there's egos involved. I knew not acquiescing could potentially rob me a lot, but I wouldn't do it because I believe that self-respect and dignity are important. And I wanted to tell that story because I felt in my heart it was very important story to tell to other women and other humans that maybe find themselves in a situation where somebody that's more powerful than them asks them to do something they're not comfortable with.
Were there ramifications when you didn't do it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And what happened?
I ultimately lost the game.
Wow.
Do you think that's how you lost the game, when he decided that you had kind of showed him up and therefore he wasn't going to play along anymore and he was going to take his money and ball and go home?
It was certainly part of the equation.
Wow.
There were other factors that came into play. But the big thing was, you know, it was kind of a demand for submission and complicity, because I had stopped catering exclusively to his needs and carrying out some of the sort of demands that he was making of the game. And, you know, I was starting to sort of have my own agency and become powerful in my own right and not just be a pawn. A minion. Yeah.
Has he apologized since this all came out, the book came out? There, you know, you have A-list actors playing you and directing you, A-list directors. Has there been any apologies?
No.
Wait a second here.
Wow. You think it would be like, you know, hey, look, that was dumb. Yeah. And I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Wait, Molly, can we just go after him a little more? If the guy's an a-hole. Come on.
No. If there's any kind of decency, you apologize. That's how you know someone's character. You go, you know what? That was wrong. That was rude. But, you know, there's a lot of these guys, unfortunately, that their egos are so large and they're so it's beyond them. They can't even think that. They think oh my God, apology. Mm-hmm. So have you been threatened at all before this came out? When you were writing it, when people knew you were writing, or you were looking for a movie deal? Were you threatened?
There was a couple sort of, I wouldn't necessarily call them threats. People were very careful. But there was definitely some unpleasant conversations.
Yeah.
And there was also back channeling big time.
Were you scared ever?
There were times in my career that I was definitely scared, but I felt the weight of the power that was stacked against me, for sure. Because when I wrote the book and I handled it I stayed within my moral code. I really did. Yeah. And I could have gotten 7-figure advances if I was willing to tell what I knew. I proceeded with according to what I felt was my line in the sand in terms of morality. And then when I took it to Hollywood, I was taking meetings and I would get something kind of set up and then it would fall apart because people, very powerful people, did not want this story to get any more oxygen. And so I definitely felt the weight of the power stacked against me. But, you know, survival mode is an interesting place to be. In some ways, I found it to be the most liberating, the most fearless and the most confident I've ever felt.
You know, interestingly, Molly, when you talk about that, you had to have that kind of confidence and you had to feel liberated and you had to feel empowered. Aaron Sorkin said that he'd never met someone so down on her luck, but so full of herself.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, he went on. He said he spoke to you for 73 hours. Wow. Is that true? He spoke to you? Wow. I mean, I haven't spoken to my wife for 73 hours.
Literally got interrogated by Aaron Sorkin every day for 8 months.
Wow.
It's crazy. And he obviously had the guts as well to do what he did.
You there?
Oh, we lost her. All right, great time for a break. you're listening to Gervie's Law. We're going to have Molly back. I don't know. Maybe she just got overwhelmed talking to someone for 73 hours.
Maybe it's somebody that doesn't want her talking.
Maybe she figured that we were going to talk to her for 73 hours. We only have 30 minutes more, but we're right here in L.A. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. You got
to know. Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Know when to run.
You never All right, Carrie, since when you start singing?
When you're sitting at the table. Oh, my God, you're singing. I've never heard you sing.
I've sung
well,
with
we've
you
all
before.
Sing in a group. In a group, we have.
Molly, you care to sing?
Every gambler knows. I mean, nobody knows this part.
Yeah, no.
I mean, we could all sing together. Could start.
We could.
We could start.
No, let's skip that. You know, there's more important stuff. Let's talk about the actual game. We're talking to Molly Bloom, who is the poker princess. The book is called Molly's Game, the true story of the 26-year-old woman behind the most exclusively high-stakes underground poker game in the world. And if you haven't seen the movie, you really have to see it. It is an incredible movie. In fact, I just watched it again this past week because I'd forgotten
it's
about
it. It's so good.
It's really engaging. Jessica Chastain did such a great job. Molly, would you agree with that? Or do you think she sucked?
Oh my god.
What is wrong with you?
She was so good at
amazing.
Yes. She's so good. You you have any say in who was cast, or was that all Aaron?
So it's so funny because when Aaron called me to tell me he was in, he said, "I have good news and bad news." The good news is I want to write this movie. The bad news is you're not going to have any creative control.
Mm.
And I kind of thought about it for a while, and I called him back, and I was like, I'm your only source material.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, normally his process is read a bunch of interviews or biographies or, you know, sort of history books about the subject that he's writing, like Steve Jobs or Mark Zuckerberg or Billy Beane, and then go off into his lair and kind of create this story and interview people if he can, but a lot of times he can't. But with me, there wasn't anyone writing biographies about me. So
right.
I worked with Aaron for 8 months and we became great friends, and I got this very exciting and compelling view into his process and watched him construct the story. And, you know, he's one of the greats. What an experience to have. But along the way, because we were working together so much and we were so close, he would tell me and, you know, sort of talk to me a lot about which actress wants to play it. And as soon as he said Jessica Chastain, I was like, oh, it has to be her.
Yeah.
Because I fell in love with her in Zero Dark Thirty. I just thought
me too. I love
so
that movie.
Good.
It's a great movie.
So good.
She has like, her, you know, she was just such a badass.
Yeah.
And I also really like what she stands for in real life. You know, I think that she uses her platform responsibly and courageously. And, you know, I was like, please, we have to get Jessica. And when she said she was in, you know, it was like, you know, a dream come true.
You know, it's really, it was odd because so many times there were shots that looked just like you. Like, did you not see that? I mean, it was really crazy. And some of the shots that they took to promote the movie, you guys look a lot alike. But, I mean, they did a lot.
I think Molly's more attractive, actually.
They're both gorgeous.
Oh,
my gosh. I mean, I like Jessica with red hair.
She's
so with the
gorgeous.
Brown hair, yeah, it was
but
crazy.
Just
but
picture Molly with red hair. It's same.
No,
they're
it's
perfect.
True. You both are beautiful girls. So, but
I don't think I could pull off the red hair, honestly.
No. Oh, yeah, you could. You could.
Well,
you could.
I mean, it was super crazy because I wanted to see the movie for the first time at the premiere with my family, with a group, you know, with the 2,000 people, and everyone was telling me I was crazy, but I'm like, you know, if I sit in a room by myself and watch this movie, I'm not going to survive that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just going to have to like get thrown into it. But I'm sitting there and I'm watching this movie and I'm like, first of all, it's my whole life flashing in front of my eyes for 2 hours and 12 minutes. Every single scene that he wrote actually happened.
Wow.
Now, I'm a lot smarter and funnier in this movie than I was in real life, that's for sure. But, you know, Jessica's affect and her...
But how did you feel in the scene where you get beat up, where Jessica got beat up? I mean, that must have been painful to watch.
Yeah, it was, because Aaron worked with me a lot on that scene because he wanted it to be really accurate and not an overshot, overblown, violent, you know, like he wanted it to resonate. And he did just a masterful job of recreating it. And yeah, it was hard.
I bet. And was there anything in the film where you go, yeah, that was a little exaggerated, or you know what, that didn't really hit the mark. That was it was worse than that.
Yeah, he inflated my LSAT score a lot.
Oh, my gosh.
That's all right.
That's not too bad.
How about the skiing injury? Because it looked like it's amazing that you came back from that, because the scene at the beginning, it looks like you'll never... I'm not talking about the one that took you out of skiing, but the one when you were real young.
12 years old.
Yeah, when you were 12 years old. I mean, I was looking, I was saying, it's amazing she's walking, and look, and now she's training for the Olympics, and she's a favorite in the moguls.
Yeah, it was really crazy. You know, I grew up in a family of, we were skiers. That's what we did. My dad was obsessed with mogul skiing, and we went skiing every single weekend. And my brothers and I started to compete locally. And my youngest brother, Jeremy, was an absolute phenom.
Right. Olympic skier.
And Jordan, went to the Olympics twice, won world championships three times, was number one in the world at 19. And then also went on to get drafted in the NFL.
He's
played for the NFL. It's crazy.
We know that Jordan's the cardiothoracic surgeon. What's Jeremy doing now?
Yeah. Jeremy has is the CEO and has raised like $80 million for a tech startup. When he retired from sports, he decided he was going to learn about technology and is incredibly successful and just killing it. And, you know, the kid has a Midas touch, like everything he touches. It's crazy.
It's like your whole family does. The whole family does. Like, this is insane. I mean, you've become, you know, a celebrity.
Can I have your parents?
Yeah, no, I know, really. They did something really right.
Yeah, they did. You know, we owe them a ton. But it wasn't an easy family to grow up in, not exactly knowing who you were. But anyway, so I was competing locally and I was doing well, not like Jeremy well, but I was doing well. And then I got diagnosed with really severe scoliosis, and it was so severe that almost my entire spine needed to be fused, you know, and to become a solid bone with no movement in my vertebrae. And then they put two metal rods in it, and the doctors were like, yeah, you should get a new hobby. Mogul skiing isn't really feasible for you. And that pissed me off. And I did, you know, I was like, I'm going to do this anyway. And kudos to my parents for kind of sort of being okay with that. Because it really taught me an incredibly important lesson, which is, you know, everyone can, the experts, the whole world, everyone can tell you that something's impossible and you can't do it. But a lot of times you still can.
I can't stand when doctors tell you this is how it is.
I know.
Because everybody's different. Everybody's will is different. Everybody's, you know, and it's. So they told that there's a woman who was the prima ballerina at the New York Ballet, Wendy, and I can't blanking on her last name. She had horrible scoliosis. She didn't even care. Mm-hmm. It didn't affect her. She's, you know, she's 40, late 40s before she left, and she was still dancing fine. So isn't that amazing? And if anybody would have told her as she was a kid, oh, you have scoliosis, you can't do this, she may have never become
But that's an individual who has that kind of drive. And that drive translated into the poker games. A lot of people want to know, Molly, how did you figure out how to run these things, especially when you did it on your own? When you went to New York, you were in L.A. for several years, went to New York. How did you get paid, and what happened with all the dollars, the millions of dollars? You had all these people like Leonardo DiCaprio, Ben Affleck, Matt Damon, Macaulay Culkin, all of these people, then lesser-known people like Heli Named, Phil Ivey, Andy Beal, all these people. And how did you figure out how to run this thing, and how did it work? I want to try it.
Oh, my God.
Well, I have a crush on your career. After getting a federal indictment, I was, you know, because I wanted to be an attorney when I was younger.
But, it always looks better from the outside.
I think it's really cool. I would love to be in court.
You can still do You can.
I want to hear what you
can still.
Hey, listen, I'm a lawyer. I'm asking the questions. This is a deposition,
okay.
Molly. I asked you.
All right.
You can't object.
Early on, right? I go to this first poker game, and these guys start walking in the room, and I'm watching this thing go down, and I am like, "Wow, this is a crazy opportunity." This is a crazy opportunity for a 24-year-old kid from Loveland, Colorado, to have instant access to capital, to power, to information. And I just saw it as a really compelling opportunity. So, you know, I learned about poker. That took a little bit of time. I wanted to get fluent in the language. I wanted to learn the rules and the objectives. And then what I did is I studied the players. And what I went in it from that angle. Who are these people and why the heck with their access to anyone and anything, why do they want to come play in this game religiously? No matter what the room looks like, no matter what the cheese plate looks like in the stupid plate, you know, it didn't matter. None of it matters. And so I started to see that so much of this was about the experience of it all, the escapism, the fantasy, having a story to tell, being part of this sort of, you know, competition with each other. And you know, I started to really build on this experience from start to finish, from the time they walked in the room. What did it smell like? What did it look like? Were the stakes correct in terms of keeping them engaged?
How did you collect the money? I want to know how you collected money.
Oh, my Lord. Look at this. He really wants to learn.
I do. I want to know how you got millions of dollars and then you lost millions of dollars.
Did you? Wait. And let us know. Do you have anything left?
You can object to that. It's compound questions. Three questions
in
one.
No. It's committing crimes is very expensive.
Oh, I'm sure.
Breaking the law is very expensive.
Only when you get caught.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, that's for sure. Right. So here's the deal about collections. And in particular, this became very important when I became the bank, when I started bankrolling the games and extending credit and making good on the games. There are a couple factors that were very important. First of all, I had to vet people properly. I had to find out exactly how much liquidity they had because, you know, there's a lot of grandstanders in Los Angeles.
Yes.
And in New York. Yeah.
So I needed to do my research to make sure that they had liquidity. Second, I had to have a game that no one was recreating. Biggest stake, most action, no pros. You could sit next to your hero. Hedge funds are getting made. The product had to be the best on the market.
And there's no pros. I didn't know that. Go ahead.
Yeah, no pros.
Wow.
And then, these people have no better game to go to. And B, there's huge social consequence to stiffing this game. And those were the two major things that kept me safe.
And how did you get the money? You transferred into a bank account?
Oh, you're talking about how it was all checks and wires by the time it got to, you know, the games got to be 50,000 buy-in, 250,000 buy-in. People weren't bringing cash anymore.
Were they stiffing you? Who stiffed you? Did Alex Rodriguez stiff you?
Oh, my God.
No, exactly.
What about Nelly? Nelly did, didn't he? I know that guy.
No. I didn't really get stiffed very often, to tell you the truth. And when I did get stiffed, by the time I started getting stiffed, it was usually my fault. I bet on someone. I got reckless with someone. I got so good at ascertaining whether people had the money to pay. But at the, you know, towards the end, I got reckless. And so.
And that's how it all ended. We still have one more segment. We got to take a quick break, Molly. It's really a joy talking to you.
Okay.
We are going to be back in a minute. You're listening to Molly Bloom, and we are Alan Gervin and Carrie Kasem right here on Gervie's Law, KABC.
Radio 790
KABC. All right, we're back. Viva Molly's Game. Vegas and Molly's Game. The book is Molly's Game. The movie's Molly's Game. Everything's Molly's Game. Have you really, have things changed for you? I mean, I know you're living a life kind of away from all of the excitement and the action that you had back in Colorado. Have things been different, or people still kind of have a lot of questions to ask you when they meet you and know who you are?
My life is radically different. But there are some similarities in that, you know, I always have something that
I'm focused on, that I want to be consumed with in terms of, something that is career-wise. So there's that, but that's pretty much the only similarity. And I still like a little bit of adrenaline. You know, I like heli skiing and sailing and stuff like that. But other than that, my life is unrecognizable. I mean, you know.
Are you going to write another book?
I'm writing one right now.
Awesome.
So tell us about
it. Yes, a little bit, just a little bit,
yeah,
a little trailer.
Yeah, we're going to get this out into the media.
Yeah.
You know, this book is more about overcoming odds in any category. It's about what I've learned about, you know, looking at a goal and realizing that you are a massive underdog, and what that looks like from strategy to mindset to, you know, character building and really just a how to win. And it's both, you know, sort of emotionally, mentally, physically.
Do some of the participants in the game, and I know there's a lot of them, some people know these names, some people don't, do they ever come to you with any ideas? I mean, obviously you were well-liked. And by the way, before you answer that question, I do have to ask this, because every time I have a vision of the game, I think of Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen, Michelle from Full House. Were they really there, and were they playing poker?
What?
You know, in the early days in L.A., the game was just sort of a social event. And so you would have celebrities come and just like hang out. As the games got more serious and the stakes got bigger, I eliminated that piece. It was not a spectator sport anymore because it was just too serious. You know?
So you got rid of
it's a lot of money, I guess.
You got rid of the Olsens?
Yeah, like I didn't get rid of the Olsens, but I got rid of the whole, you know, we eliminated the whole sort of spectator sport aspect to it, because privacy was really paramount. I mean, people were losing millions of dollars. You know, I up until in New York, I saw someone lose $100 million in a night. These games were insanity.
Wow.
Wow.
I mean, $100 million? Whoa. That's crazy.
$100 million.
And they actually lost it? Where'd the money go?
How many people won it, you mean?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
I mean, if people are losing, someone's winning.
Yes. Oh, my Lord.
Yeah,
that's a lot of money.
It was spread out between 5 people, I think.
Wow.
That's, I mean,
it's crazy.
I mean, you must be a billionaire at that point. You're a billionaire, you lose $100 million. Yeah. And,
but still, it's a lot.
It's a lot of money.
When you're a billionaire.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
It's an unhealthy number.
Some of this sport is kind of unhealthy. There's a lot of unhealthy mindsets and people in it.
Yeah.
I was going to say, because we only have a few minutes, I want to know how you lost your money, because, first of all, people want to know the legal, this is a legal show, so we have to talk about the fact that eventually you were taking a cut from some of the pot.
Yeah.
And that's what was illegal versus just serving a cheese plate.
Right. So for 7 years, there was this unspoken rule that if you want your seat and you want credit, you take care of the game runner, the owner. That was me. So, you know, I was making $4 million a year and paying my taxes.
And paying your taxes.
Mm-hmm. And I had retained criminal attorneys on both coasts, you know, and they said, they analyzed the federal statutes and they said, they gave me a list of things not to do, and they said, and especially don't take a rake, meaning don't take a percentage of each pot. Don't behave like Vegas. And I was working on tips, and it was, you know, it was extraordinarily profitable. But what happened is I got sloppy, and I started extending too much credit and having too much debt on the street. Remember, by this time, I'm bankrolling these games entirely. And so I got sloppy and I started accruing way too much debt. And so I started taking a rake to account for my downside.
Did the FBI take all your money?
Yep. All my money got seized in asset forfeiture. And they told me that, you know, if your client wants to come in and talk to us about what she knows and how she was making this money, then we can do that. But at that point, they weren't pursuing an indictment. So I most certainly did not want to go in and go on record and talk about this
criminal enterprise that I was running. And so I just went away. And then 2 years later, I got arrested at gunpoint, 17 FBI agents, semi-automatic weapons. They put the piece of paper in front of me, the United States of America versus Molly Bloom. I was thrown into this indictment. And, you know, kind of facing some real prison time.
And what
and
I,
some real tough to,
what I think real is really decisions. Important, because we only have 2 minutes left, but what is really important is that's where you did the right thing, because you could have thrown so many people under the bus. You probably could have worked with the government in terms of getting you did get a light sentence, obviously, but things could have changed. But you really, your integrity, you said, no, I'm going to take it like a woman.
Yeah, they were. Thanks for that. They were offering me a deferred prosecution or full immunity and to give my money back if I was willing to become a confidential informant. And, you know, I had come to this realization years before that I had made all these choices, right? Like, no one twisted my arm. I had a good thing going. I chose to break the law. These people that I was supposed to turn around and, you know, take down were people that had just simply come to my game, supported me, paid my bills. And I just didn't think that that was the right thing to do. So.
Wow. That's such
a that deal, and
it's just an amazing ending.
It is.
You know, I don't want to ruin the film, but that's part of it, and it's such a beautiful thing. And it's like, wow,
yeah.
Most people would have taken that deal,
and they
wouldn't have cared. You would have,
yes, I would have.
Yeah, I wouldn't have.
The book is called Wally's Game: The True Story of the 26-Year-Old Woman Behind the Most Exclusively High Stakes Underground Poker Game in the World. Make it a next book, Wally. Make it a shorter title, please. A short title.
Yeah, I will. For sure.
Thank you. The movie's called Molly's Game. Don't miss it. Molly Bloom, it's been absolutely an honor to speak to you, and good luck with everything
Likewise.
You're doing. And congratulations on turning your life around. It's amazing.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
Thanks for being with us today in Gervie's Law. Well, that's going to do it for another week of Gervie's Law. Carrie, that was a lot of fun.
That was super fun.
Yeah.
Super
she's
fun.
Great. She's
yeah.
great. We'll have to get her come in when she's in L.A.
Yeah.
If she ever comes back to this Sin City. All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. We will see you next week.
This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.